hundreds of thousands of foreclosures means there are lots of vacant properties. In some places, empty homes are a magnet for thieves and criminals. But in some other places, an empty house is an opportunity to party.
New tonight, hundreds of people, booze, and a vacant house. That's all that was needed for a huge illegal party in Sandy Springs.
We had a party, a crazy house party. We got drunk, got stupid, house party.
Thousands of Americans are still losing their homes every month, and until the housing market bounces back, many of those houses will be vacant until they're sold. It's a stupid, crazy house party all across the nation on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Friday the 13th, November 13th. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry.
On this unlucky day, there's a dispute between the Pentagon and Foggy Bottom over the strategy in Afghanistan. Is that possible? A look at Obama's rejected Afghanistan options and a possible hint of White House priorities. Also, a peek at the Palin book. It gets rolled out next week. And surviving the end of the world. It's trivial and only a movie.
But first, John Tyus is with us. He's a member of the Downtown Brooklyn Campaign for Families United for Racial and Economic Equality. John, you surveyed downtown Brooklyn and counted the empty units, the empty homes.
Yes. As part of the Rights to the City Coalition, Fury and its members went out and walked the districts of downtown Brooklyn and Bushwick. We identified 234 vacant
condos or homes.
That's correct. And many of them were partially vacant and some stalled projects. This creates two problems.
Okay.
When you take away the footprint of housing that is affordable in low-income communities, you displace families. The additional problem is the vacancies create hazards for the communities themselves.
Because no one's taking care of the property?
Exactly. Just simply putting up a fence does not protect the community from rodents and other factors in the community.
Okay, John Tyus, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
Well, here's a headline. How about KSM goes to ground zero? A White House official says Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the self-proclaimed mastermind of the September 11th attacks, will be brought to New York to face trial in a civilian federal court. Bringing Mohammed and four other Guantanamo Bay detainees to U.S. soil to face trial is a key step in President Obama's plan to close the Cuban detention center. President Obama spoke to reporters last hour in Tokyo after his meeting with the Japanese prime minister. He was asked when we could expect a decision on the strategy in Afghanistan.
The decision will be made soon. It will be one that is fully transparent so that the American people understand exactly what we're doing and why we're doing it and what it will entail.
Military prosecutors in the Fort Hood story plan to seek the death penalty for the alleged Fort Hood shooter, Major Nidal Malik Hassan. The Army formally charged Hassan with 13 counts of premeditated murder. The last execution of an active duty serviceman took place in 1961.
In what could be the largest counterterrorism seizure in history, federal prosecutors are moving to seize four American mosques and a Manhattan skyscraper owned by a Muslim organization. Prosecutors contend the Alavi Foundation funnels the rental income come to support Iran's nuclear program. And starting next summer, there will be no longer any overdraft fees on ATMs or debit cards unless you agree ahead of time nicely to pay those extra charges. After 6 days of gains, the Dow has dropped nearly 100 points. The S&P fell 11 points and the NASDAQ was slightly down as well. But looking at home numbers, foreclosures are up right now about 19% since a year ago. Unemployment still above 10%. This problem is not going away any soon. You're probably going to see more foreclosures in the future. And we're wondering, how many vacant homes do you have in your neighborhood? Look down your block. How many empty houses are there? Let us know at 8778-MYTAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're going to talk about Americans, their homes, and their empty homes in a moment.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
So if you're looking just at statistics, it's kind of a mixed picture on homes. Foreclosures are still up about 19% since the same time last year. But in recent months, the number of new foreclosures has been going down. At the same time, we still have unemployment of 10%. And the one thing that is not changing is that these houses, the housing market has not bounced back yet, which means these homes that are vacant are still vacant. And it's causing a problem in a number of communities. We're joined by John Tyus again. He's a member of the Downtown Brooklyn Campaign for Families United for Racial and Economic Equality. And we heard him saying earlier that he counted 234 empty units just in downtown Brooklyn, and there's about 601 so far that they've counted across the city. We're joined also by Luther Bradley. He's a block captain for the Neighborhood Watch Group in Sherwood Forest, Detroit. Good morning, Luther.
Good morning. How are you doing, Celeste?
I am doing well. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. I just came in from a long run, so I'm a little winded.
But on that run, did you count the vacant homes on your block?
Well, actually, on my block, there's two of them.
Two.
And they've been vacant for about a year and a half or so.
Are they for sale?
One of them are for sale. The other one is just vacant. Apparently, somebody kind of walked away from it.
Okay. We're also joined by Karen Mines and McInerney. She's a councilwoman in Sandy Springs, Georgia, outside Atlanta. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. So tell me what you're hearing from your councilwoman in Sandy Springs. What are the people of the community in Sandy Springs saying to you? You have a lot of vacant homes there?
We do have several vacant homes. I would say, it would certainly be in the, 100 or so.
Luther is in Detroit, and in Metro Detroit, one of the things we know from RealtyTrack statistics is that one out of every 15.5 households have gone into foreclosure in the past 3 years. That's a lot of homes, Luther. And I'm just wondering if the communities there are beginning to look like a smile with gapped teeth.
Well, I think most people will think that. There has been a number of homes. Like, for example, we've got 300 or so homes in our community, and about, I would say, 25 to 30 of them are vacant homes.
Okay.
But we have seen there's been a small trickle of people buying these homes now at some reduced prices, but they're buying them.
Okay, that's good.
It's looking up.
Well, you and Karen seem to be in neighborhoods that most of us would think are kind of insulated. So for some people, it may be a surprise that you have quite as many vacant homes as you can. But John Tyus, you're in downtown Brooklyn. It's no surprise that there would be vacant homes. I guess the surprise is just the number. So when you have these vacant properties, you were saying that part of the problem is that they're not kept up. How long does it take for between the time that when somebody leaves a property and leaves it alone and it's empty and vacant before that property becomes a problem?
Well, essentially the properties become a problem as soon as the construction stops. And what we've seen is most of the permits are for a full year. And in many cases, developers are building properties very slowly now because of the financial crisis and the difficulty in liquidating them. So in downtown Brooklyn, where we've identified approximately 126 buildings in downtown Brooklyn in a community that has a poverty rate of about 22%, many of our constituents, our members, are low-income working families, and they make, on average, about $18,000 a year. And when you see buildings going up for $600,000, $700,000, and $800,000 in that type of community, those buildings were not built for the existing community,
right.
And that is a problem for us.
So there's vulnerability economically because the developers are trying to make units for the middle class, not for low income. And there's vulnerability from the fact that they're vacant and they become sources of potential crime. Luther and John, it seems to me that you possibly share this experience. I mean, one of the appalling things about this recession is there's no real program nationwide for dealing with these foreclosures and these vacant properties. And it occurs to me that in both Detroit and in New York, one of the ways neighborhoods change is that people take matters into their own hands and become squatters or reclaim properties and decide to do what developers won't do. Any sign of that going on in Detroit, Luther?
Well, absolutely. We have what we would call our Sherwood Forest Association. And within the Sherwood Forest, I'm a block captain. We also have house monitors. And so we've decided we're going to take this in our own hands. And so we've gone out to each block and says, okay, why don't you take that particular house that is vacant and make sure you clean the you know, clean the neighborhood. I mean, clean the grass. You cut the grass, rake the leaves, make sure nobody's coming in there, squatters. And we do that from block to block, and we meet like every quarter, and we talk about those things. So we have kind of said, you know, we're not going to just let this thing fall apart because we really enjoy our neighborhood and we love our community. So we're actually doing something about it. And what happens is that you will be amazed at how many people will say, you know, I like this, and I'm
being that involved.
To do it.
We actually have a phone call from one of our listeners from Detroit talking about this issue.
My name's John, and I'm calling from Detroit, Michigan. We're about 11 miles from downtown, which means that we see absolutely none of the money or effort that's allegedly being put into making Detroit a better place. We're left to fend for ourselves. Luckily, I live on a block that's about 60% vacant, but the 40% of us that remain work hard to keep it nice. We take care of the yards that are in abandoned homes and try to keep the strippers away as much as possible.
He's not talking about people who remove their clothes. He's talking about people who strip copper pipes and wiring out of homes to make money off the metal. But, John, is this kind of thing happening in downtown Brooklyn across New York as well?
Well, what we're finding in downtown Brooklyn and in other areas throughout the city is that the vacant properties are being pretty much policed by security guards, and they're not left totally abandoned, if you will. One of the problems we do have with this current situation is the speaker, the city council, and the mayor come forward with a program called HARP. It's the Housing Asset Renewal Program. And this program is the first step by the city to deal with the vacant condo problem in New York.
But there's still problems with this. Very quickly, Karen, one of the problems in your neighborhood that you're hearing from your constituents is that these homes are being used for both illegal and legal parties. Very quickly, can you tell us what's happening here and what problem is causing?
Yes, because the properties have been are vacant and either are for sale or have been withdrawn for the market and until it stabilizes. They have websites. Two of the homes have websites that indicate that the home is available for weekly rentals. And one is a wedding venue. But others, the most egregious one occurred on Halloween night, and a promoter for a party made something like $20,000.
Wow.
And there were, the police estimated 1,000 people.
And that's what we're talking about, really, is people not being in control of the properties in their own neighborhoods. That's Karen Mizen-McInerney, councilwoman in Sandy Springs, Georgia. Outside Atlanta, we also heard from Luther Bradley in the Sherwood Forest District of Detroit and John Tyus from downtown Brooklyn. Thanks to all of you. It is 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in on news stories.
President Obama is on his first presidential trip to Asia. So far today, he made a joint appearance with the Japanese prime minister in Tokyo. Here's some of what he said.
I did thank the people of Japan and the prime ministers for the powerful commitment of a $5 billion over the next 5 years to support our shared civilian efforts in Afghanistan, as well as the commitment of $1 billion to Pakistan.
President Obama also said his decision on U.S. strategy in Afghanistan will come soon. The next stop on his four-nation tour is Singapore. A White House official says Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the self-proclaimed mastermind of the September 11th attacks, will be brought to New York to face trial in a civilian federal court. Bringing Mohammed and four other Gitmo detainees to U.S. soil to face trial is a key step in President Obama's plan to close the detention center. An Army psychiatrist, Major Nidal Malik Hassan, has been charged with 13 counts of premeditated murder in the Fort Hood shootings. Under the military's legal system, the charges would make Hassan eligible for the death penalty if convicted.
Government health officials now say about 22 million Americans have contracted the H1N1 virus since April. Here's Ann Schuchat of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
The estimation method that we are using now, we believe, gives a bigger picture, probably a more accurate picture of the full scope of the pandemic.
About 4,000 people have died from the virus so far. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. And coming up, big book release next week. Sarah Palin's Going Rogue is hitting the shelves, and we're going to get a peek inside the cover in a minute.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway,
from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
That's right. Takeout this morning, and sitting here at the counter, Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times,
morning.
And Ibrahim Abdelmateen, Takeaway Sports contributor.
Good morning
to both of you. Let's begin with you, Louise. I seem to remember back in 2003, Paul Wolfowitz describing that the invasion of Iraq might have some business benefits for American companies, in that once we get this little invasion out of the way, there
right.
will be all kinds of business opportunities. Your colleagues at the Times have been taking a look at the track record of getting American company contracts inside
right.
Iraq. How are we doing on that?
Not very well. So even though Iraqi imports have gone up significantly, they've more than doubled since 08, the amount that's coming from American companies is staying flat. One of the examples in the story I thought was the most interesting is FedEx. So, you know, FedEx
right.
braved all of the dangers, flew into the red zone, one of the places that most businesses avoided, and just last month they have suspended their business there because the Iraqi government gave a huge contract to a Russian shipping company rather than FedEx.
And, wow. and if there's anything you probably don't want to do in Iraq, it's drive around a lot and fly into the airport continually. And FedEx did
right.
that. And they're rewarded by having to compete
no
with a
business.
Russian company.
And then, of course, you know, everyone talked about oil, you know, what might
right.
happen with
sure.
oil. And Exxon, which is a big American oil company, is still waiting on a service contract they've been trying to get. So it's really not a lot of success. And if you think about it, Americans there are the occupier. There is huge anti-American feeling. And so the business instead is going to companies from Turkey. And if you recall, Turkey would not even let the U.S. use its air bases.
Right, in Incirlik, sure. Is this about the U.S. government deliberately downplaying the U.S. companies to try to make it look good, like it's not manipulating the situation? Or is it the restoration of the status quo before the war, where Russia was the big player in Iraq?
It may be part of that. And the other thing is the security costs there. You know, American companies are looking at how much they'd have to pay to be secure in doing businesses there. I think this is one of those situations where it's a bit kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Right.
Because, you know, if there was a ton of American businesses getting money there, I think that my colleagues at the time would also write a
right.
story about how, oh my gosh, America's
We're
colonizing Iraq.
Right.
So it could
right.
go either way.
You all ready for next week, Louise?
I'm ready.
Super Freakonomics Week. Dubner's going to be here. We're going to have you in all week talking about the Super Freakonomics. It's a way of looking at the world. Thanks, Louise.
Thanks.
Now to sports
Super
with the Takeaway
Freakonomics.
Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdelmateen. So, Ibrahim, you called it in last night's game between the 49ers and the Chicago Bears. You said the 49ers were going to pull it out, and they did. They won 10-6. What happened?
Well, basically what happens is that the Chicago Bears defense came to play, but the San Francisco 49ers defense really came to play and took five picks away from quarterback Jay Cutler. And Jay Cutler basically looked very weak in his passing game. He's one of the best passers in the league, but he threw five interceptions.
Yeah, not a good game
for him. Both teams looked like
the
Pee Wee League, I tell you. It was not a good game.
We have at least one huge game coming up this weekend. This is one that everyone's going to be watching, and that's between the Colts, who are undefeated, and the Patriots. This is the big game of the weekend, isn't it?
This is the big game. It's a Sunday night game. So the last time that the Patriots were in the Super Bowl was 2008. They ran into an undefeated pass rush of the Giants. They were undefeated, and they ran into the pass rush of the Giants, and then they
right.
got stopped. Well, that season, they played the undefeated Indianapolis Colts, and they prevailed. Now, fast forward to 2009, the Patriots are more down to earth, but they have Brady, who's thrown for at least 300 yards in three consecutive games. Their running back, Lawrence Maroney, has a rushing touchdown in three consecutive games, so they're playing like it's 2007. Now, the Colts, on the other hand, Peyton Manning has thrown 297 touchdown passes in this decade, and Brett Favre in the 90s had 235. Peyton Manning is on pace to be one of the best
right.
quarterbacks of all time. So they come together. The real game changer in this one is Dwight Freeney. He's the defensive end for the Indianapolis Colts. He has a sack in at least every game this season. So the pressure on Tom Brady, I think, is going to be the difference. It's going to be a lower scoring game, and I think the Indianapolis Colts are going to pull
you
it out.
You think they're going to remain
yes.
undefeated?
You think
okay.
the Colts are going to win it?
Yes.
Yep,
Colts are
going to
win it.
Interesting. Because of the pass rush. That's
because
why.
Of the pass
okay.
rush. All right,
Takeaway
we shall see. Well, we're going to add to our takeouts this morning one of your colleagues, Louise Story. Kate Zernike joins us, New York Times national correspondent. Good morning, Kate.
Morning.
So the Sarah Palin book comes out, right?
Tuesday.
And this is the first sitting governor, it seems, in American history to resign in order to spend more time with her ghostwriter. Is that correct?
Exactly.
All right. So what hints are we getting from the book here so far?
You know, so far it looks like the big story in the book is something that we pretty much knew already, which is that the McCain people and the Palin people really didn't get along.
Right.
The biggest sort of most tantalizing new detail seems to be that the McCain campaign stuck her with a $500,000 legal bill at the end of the thing. And she asked for a little help paying it, and they said, well, if we had won, we would have paid it, but we lost, so you're stuck with
it. That's her side of the story. They say they never heard anything about that.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, they can write their own book now. We can't tell you. What does she say about some of these moments that became part of popular culture, like the interview with Katie Couric?
Well, she says Katie Couric was biased. And the interesting thing about Katie Couric is she said she did the interview initially because she felt sorry for Katie Couric because Nicole Wallace, who's one of McCain's top people, who I believe had worked for Couric, said that Couric had low self-esteem. So Sarah said she felt sorry for Katie and did the interview for that reason.
So the book is called Going Rogue. And,
Going Rogue.
You know, these books are either rollouts for some sort of campaign or a kind of attempt to be confessional and to be forgiven for lapses of the past. Which is this?
You know, it's unclear. She apparently told Oprah that she, or did not rule out with Oprah that that she might want a TV show of her own. I mean, the question for Palin has been, is she going to run a campaign or is she going to do something like that,
be a
media superstar?
Any insight into her very interesting family?
I think we're going to get some insight into apparently she was not, the McCain campaign sort of put out a press release about her daughter's pregnancy. She felt that glamorized it. So maybe we'll get a little more insight about her feelings about that.
Well, she's on Oprah next week. The book comes out on Tuesday. Kate Czernicki, New York Times national correspondent. Thanks for that takeout.
Sure.
So this is our theme song for Sarah Palin here on the program. Louise, you like it?
It's I don't think I listen to it a lot. I'll leave it to you guys.
We should have Sarah Palin on, I think.
Singing?
Yeah, we'll book her.
Talk about business.
Get to work on that, guys. Bob Dylan on The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, wither the White House and Afghanistan. We're going to talk about the details of a leaked warning to the president, which may be guiding the Afghan strategy policy that's currently being developed. That story in just a few moments. Right now, let's check in on the top news stories at 31 minutes after the hour. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed may soon be a short cab ride away from ground zero. The self-proclaimed mastermind of the September 11th attacks will be moved to New York to face a civilian trial. And speaking to reporters in Tokyo this morning, President Obama had this to say.
I am absolutely convinced that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed will be subject to the most exacting demands of justice. The American people will insist on it, and my administration will insist on it.
The actual transfer of the suspects, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and four other suspects, isn't expected for weeks because formal charges haven't been filed. Also in Tokyo, the president said his decision about how many troops to send to Afghanistan will come soon. Japan has pledged $5 billion for the civilian effort in that country and another billion for Pakistan.
White House lawyer Gregory Craig is expected to resign today. It would end an embattled tenure in which Craig struggled to lead the closure of Guantanamo Bay Detention Center. He's expected to be replaced by President Obama's personal lawyer, Bob Bauer. The aftermath of Tropical Storm Ida has flooded streets, shut down schools, and caused at least five deaths along the East Coast. This is the scene from Norfolk, Virginia.
That's raw sewage bubbling out of the ground. The tidal water has overwhelmed the sewage system.
The torrential rains have prompted states of emergency in Virginia and parts of New Jersey. And if you're planning a vacation, why not try out Iraq? Iraq is participating in one of the world's biggest tourism fairs in London right now, and they say that there's plenty of sunshine and lots of other beautiful landscape to visit in Iraq. Those are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
So let's give you the latest on what's going on in Afghanistan this morning. A car bomber has struck outside a NATO base in Kabul. The Taliban has claimed responsibility for this suicide bombing, which apparently targeted a coalition vehicle near Camp Phoenix. And this is one of the facilities where Afghan forces are being trained. Joining us now is Marvin Weinbaum, a scholar at the Middle East Institute, former State Department analyst on Afghanistan and Pakistan. He was U.S. Ambassador Carl Eikenberry's first briefer on Afghanistan at the State Department. Joins us from Washington, D.C. Good morning, Marvin Weinbaum.
Good morning.
So we wanted to ask you about this story that we learned yesterday, that Ambassador Carl Eikenberry's memo that was leaked that apparently warned President Obama not to increase troop levels under any circumstances in Afghanistan unless something was done about the corrupt Karzai government. Now, first of all, is this a battle between the Pentagon and the State Department like we saw during the Iraq War between Colin Powell and Donald Rumsfeld?
No, I think more interestingly, it's a battle within the military, because really we have to see Eikenberry as a former general as well as ambassador. And he's had a long-term relationship with General McChrystal and has had different views on Afghanistan for some time. So, no, it's certainly not that. And if there were a leak, it could have, and there was a leak, certainly, it could have emanated from the State Department or from the White House, but it was at a very high level.
And, you know, Stanley McChrystal, who is the commander there, has endorsed a plan for as many as 40,000 additional troops or 45,000 additional troops in Afghanistan. I guess what I'm wondering is part of the issue here, is part of the story here, that Barack Obama is really having a problem with his national security team. I mean, what do you make of a security team that delivers essentially three options that are almost identical?
Yes, I think that he's got a real problem, and of course, General Eikenberry's his concern about what would be the way in which the troops would be used has been one which he's had for some time. But these latest cables really threw a wrench into things, because I think he was approaching a final decision. But he's certainly the fact that they became public has made his job just so much more complicated. And he's, as we know, he's pulled back, apparently, from any early decision.
And, you know, I'm pretty conspiratorial, but you know how things work over there. What is the possibility that the White House actually solicited this because they want cover? They want to focus on withdrawal and not on escalation at this moment.
I think it, I wouldn't say the White House, that there are individuals there who might have seen this as a way of strengthening their argument. I think that's conceivable, knowing that Eikenberry, his general views about the concern, really, that very little progress was likely to be made with Karzai, and that with withholding them, conceivably we would have more leverage over Karzai, whether or not that's the case is hard to say, but I don't think you have to be too conspiratorial to say that there is a debate going on and someone needed to enlist high-level support, and Eikenberry could give it.
And they succeeded, apparently.
Does Eikenberry give us, is the nature of this memo just don't send more troops, or does he actually provide an option of his own for President Obama?
Well, I'm not aware that he spelled out what he thought might be the conditions under which more troops would be warranted. That would have been, of course, very helpful. But my impression about the cable, and of course, not seen any text.
Right.
My impression is that it is a litany of reasons as to why, at this time, giving the troops here, considering that, especially after a meeting, I understand that he had with Karzai, he meets with Karzai rather regularly,
right,
in which he's come away saying, you know, after this election, this man just doesn't get it. There's no likelihood here, the way things are going now, that he's going to make any kinds of changes along the lines that we've been asking for.
And that's
a reform agenda.
And that's a sentiment that Richard Holbrooke, the envoy over there, has also indicated. You know, he hasn't said explicitly he's given up on Karzai, but certainly there's a lot of frustration there. Marvin, you know, I'm wondering here if even though Karzai is the center of this memo, if the Obama administration hasn't tipped its hand in some sense by responding to this memo, by going back to the drawing board. Has suddenly the priority in Afghanistan maybe shifted away from this war of necessity, eradicate al-Qaeda, push back the Taliban, to more of when are we going to withdraw? And if that shift has happened, that's huge news.
That would be huge, very huge, because really those who look at this carefully say that that was the mistake to begin with, to really blame it all on al-Qaeda as to why we had to be there, without focusing on the regional problem there and the fact that if that region becomes explosive, as it's likely to, with an early withdrawal, a civil war in the country, and the blowback on Pakistan, that we could have a problem on our hands which really dwarfs anything like just simply the question about whether al-Qaeda is going to return or not.
So you would oppose an early withdrawal, and if that's what's going on, you would be concerned about that?
Definitely, yes. I think that we've got to look at the pending refugee crisis. Conceivably, we would see killing fields in Afghanistan, and people would look at us and say the United States bears the responsibility.
Well, trying to decipher the Eikenberry memo, which was leaked yesterday as President Obama sent his security team back to the drawing board, as we mentioned, on options in Afghanistan. Marvin Weinbaum, scholar at the Middle East Institute, former State Department analyst on Afghanistan and Pakistan, thanks so much for that briefing. Really, it was a briefing. And here is a related story. A White House official is saying this morning that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the self-proclaimed mastermind of the September 11th attacks, will be brought to New York to face trial in a civilian federal court. It's all part of the president's plan to close Guantanamo Bay. But, of course, it has huge emotional significance here in New York, where the 9/11 attacks occurred, along with the attack down at the Pentagon, bringing Mohammed and four other Guantanamo Bay detainees to U.S. soil. That's the top story this morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. We heard a curious thing from the Chinese foreign minister. As President Obama is in Asia right now, speaking in Tokyo, and he is going to be visiting China for 3 days, the Chinese foreign minister came out and made reference to, well, compared serfdom in Tibet before the Chinese invaded that country to the slavery, the years of slavery, more than 100 years of slavery in the United States, and said since President Obama is a black president and understands the slavery abolition movement and Abraham Lincoln's significance in that movement, he should understand that China liberated Tibet from serfdom. We're here now to kind of unpack what this means with Professor Robert Thurman. He's the professor of Indo-Tibetan Studies at Columbia University. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Celeste. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Fine.
Can you explain what these comments from the Chinese foreign minister meant?
It's his typical bad public relations advice that the Chinese government currently has, where they think they can impose their propaganda that they use with their own people on the world. And they think they're going to get the world to believe their ridiculous version of Tibetan history, which was that Tibetans were a slave society and that they liberated them, and the Tibetans are oh so happy, and only the Dalai Lama is unhappy, and that's because he's a bad man, and therefore they tried this ridiculous thing, and it shows how futile Obama's gesture of postponing his meeting with the Dalai Lama, official presidential meeting with Dalai Lama, in order to placate and to calm down the Chinese. They just made them more aggressive.
Right, and to certain circumstances, they said it sounded kind of like a threat to President Obama. And so the next question for me is what happens when and if the President Obama meets with the Dalai Lama? The Dalai Lama says they're probably going to meet after he returns from Asia.
I know. I mean, it's insulting to the Dalai Lama. It's false as far as history goes. Tibetans were not at all a slave society. Tibetans were quite a happy spiritual Buddhist society. They were not modern, but they were perfectly happy. They resisted the Chinese invasion and occupation very strongly, and they still do, but they are nonviolent, essentially. So they didn't resist it very effectively. They weren't well armed. And the Chinese just trying to justify their invasion, occupation, and genocidal policy by pretending that they somehow liberated the Tibetans. It's ludicrous, actually, and it's bad public relations. They should themselves meet with the Dalai Lama and stop pretending that he's the bad man, you know, and the rest of the world is confused.
Okay, Professor Thurman, in the minute that we have left, do we have any inkling of whether or not President Obama will address some of human rights issues in China, either publicly or perhaps in secret private meetings with Chinese officials?
Well, we don't have any idea, of course, what he'll do, but we hope that he will. And certainly he presents himself as someone who's trying to do something, bring change to the way of ruling, being honest and straightforward. And, you know, China needs to be confronted on its human rights behavior, this idea that just work with them, do business, make them rich, and let them push you around. And on other fronts has not worked in, so far. They still are not behaving.
Right.
And it should work if he confronts them openly. That's a good thing. He should revive that tradition.
Thanks, Professor. That's Robert Thurman, Professor of Indo-Tibetan Studies at Columbia University.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, a very non-trivial discussion of the movies of the last decade with New York Times film critic A.O. Scott. And also a very trivial discussion of, that's right, trivia. In honor of the release of 2012, this weekend our takeaway trivia question is all about surviving the end of the world. Name the character or star who survives the end of the world in the following three movies: Deep Impact, Day After Tomorrow, and the original, Planet of the Apes. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email your answer. We'll ask A.O. Scott that same question in just a few moments. But right now, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. President Obama has joined the Japanese Prime Minister in saying the U.S.-Japanese relationship needs to adapt to modern times. Both leaders say it's time to revise the nearly 50-year-old treaty that defines the ties between the two powerful world economies. The self-proclaimed September 11th mastermind, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, will be sent to New York for a federal trial along with four other Guantanamo Bay detainees. Speaking in Japan, President Obama said he would insist on what he called an exacting form of justice for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And we don't have that remark from President Obama, but he did address the issue and moving the detainees, and it'll be Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and four other Guantanamo Bay detainees is a key step in the president's plan to close that detention center in Cuba.
It's being called one of the biggest counterterrorism seizures in history. Federal prosecutors are trying to seize several U.S. mosques, bank accounts, and other assets owned by a Muslim group suspected of being controlled by Iran. And British Prime Minister Gordon Brown has renewed his call for other NATO countries to share the burden of fighting the Taliban in Afghanistan. In an interview with our partner, the BBC, Brown said he was ready to send more troops to the region, but wants other countries to contribute more. Back at home, the remnants of Tropical Storm Ida have been slamming the Atlantic seaboard with rain and gusty winds. The storm's blamed for at least five deaths. Many are without power. That's a look at some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
Let's go out to dinner and see a movie. Let's go out to dinner and see a movie.
So on our Friday movie day, we thought we'd dig a little deeper into the releases of the weekend, and A.O. Scott, film critic for the New York Times, joins us. He's also co-host of At the Movies, and you've been the critic for the New York Times, one of the movie critics of the New York Times, for 10 years now, right?
Yeah, almost exactly. I started in January of 2000, so it's been a decade.
and we're getting to the end of this decade.
Yeah.
What kind of a decade has it been in terms of movie making? You have a very interesting piece I read last night just about this interesting relationship that a critic has to have with films and directors and with audiences.
Yeah, well, I was thinking back, you know, on sort of 10 years of professional movie watching and then a previous lifetime of amateur or civilian movie watching. And it struck me, I mean, I was thinking about, you know, end of the decades, you know, you make lists, and my co-host Michael Phillips and I are counting down our 10 favorites,
right,
you know, in a traditional top 10 way on the show At the Movies. But I was thinking, you know, I think critics and the public and audience members think about movies a little bit differently. I mean, for a critic, the sort of the fallback, you know, sort of list of masterpieces has to do with great directors and great work. So
right.
I was thinking about Clint Eastwood, Pedro Almodovar, Steven Spielberg, all of whom have done great work.
Well, you make an interesting point about them, that they did their big, huge movies back in the, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s,
right,
and it gave them the ability to make much more sensitive, and you say better movies. Here's Eastwood's effort in Mystic River, Mystic River, which won the Academy Award and which you liked.
Say you were in prison?
Jesus.
Here we go. Bloody. I'm just asking.
16 years ago, I did a 2-year bid for robbery at Deer Island.
Is that going to help you find my daughter's killer? I mean, I'm just asking.
Let's forget about that. Let's get back.
Eastwood at the top of his game.
Yeah, and that's Sean Penn in one of the great film performances, I think, ever. And Eastwood, you know, turned 70 in 2000. And,
he's still going strong.
He's still going strong. And he's had, you know, Million Dollar Baby, Mystic River, the two movies about Iwo Jima, just an incredible run.
And the Detroit movie, the Gran Torino.
Yes, Gran Torino.
Also, yeah. Here's more of an indication of how audiences, though, track a decade of movies. Here's Steve Carell in The 40-Year-Old Virgin.
Wow. So many stories are running through my head right now. I dated this girl for a while, and she was really a nasty freak. She just loved to get down with sex all the time.
Is it frustrating for you when a performance like that just breaks through and everybody goes around being Steve Carell?
A little bit. I mean, I think that's a terrific movie, and that's kind of an important movie. I have a little sort of list in the Times Magazine piece this Sunday of movies that I think are the most influential. And that one, certainly being the first film directed by Judd Apatow, mm-hmm. kind of helped to launch this wave.
The Apatow era.
Yes, the Apatow era. We'll always remember, you know, the at least the second half of the decade by Seth Rogen's face everywhere you look.
Or we might just forget it.
You know, but with this divide, and you talk in your piece for the New York Times Magazine, and that's coming out this weekend, you talk about the difference between the way the critics talk about auteurs and the director's vision of movies, and the way we view them, which is Harry Potter flying by on his broom, and Lord of the Rings and Frodo venturing out towards Mount Doom,
right.
And those are the things that are really memorable to us. But does it harm our appreciation? I mean, as an amateur myself, does it harm my appreciation of movies? Exactly.
No, I don't think so. I mean, and I think often you know, movies. The best movies and the ones that really last represent a kind of a convergence of what critics are looking at and what audiences are seeing. So that there are movies that are great works by great directors that are also very popular and just sort of feed the collective imagination in the way that you're talking about.
Eastwood straddles this. I mean, in the 1970s, you know, the Dirty Harry movies, it changed the language. I mean, you have Go Ahead, Make My Day, and then you have Do You Feel Lucky, Punk, from Magnum Force. But here, this decade, it seems to me, has referenced a lot of that stuff. Here's the Coen brothers in No Country for Old Men in a scene that I want your reaction to, which seems to directly reference the Magnum Force punk, Do You Feel Lucky? This is from No Country for Old Men.
You know what date is on this coin?
No.
1958. It's been traveling 22 years to get here. And now it's here. And it's either heads or tails. And you have to say, call it.
Look, I need to know what I stand to win.
Everything.
How's that?
You stand to win everything, call it.
All right. Heads, then.
Well done.
Chilling scene. Do you feel lucky, punk?
Yeah, it comes, I think, like most of the dialogue in that movie, directly out of Cormac McCarthy's book. But yeah, well, I think that scene also gets to one of the themes that was definitely dominant both in kind of serious, ambitious filmmaking and in more popular filmmaking in the 80s, which is good and evil, and this just sort of endless struggle determined by kind of cycles of revenge.
I mean, in an American landscape, too. You've got There Will Be Blood, which is an American story, but also this classic good and evil story. Yeah. You've got 310 to Yuma, same sort of good and evil story.
And you even, you know, you have it certainly in Harry Potter and in Lord of the Rings.
Seven books sustained on vengeance.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's a fabulous piece in the Sunday New York Times. A.O. Scott wrote it, but now it's time for trivia, okay? All that high-minded stuff, we're done, dude. Strap yourself in. In honor of the release of 2012 this weekend, our takeaway trivia question is all about surviving the end of the world. Name the character or star who survives the end of the world in the following three movies. Deep Impact.
I'm just totally blanking.
Elijah Woods.
Okay.
Good luck to us all.
Okay. How about Day After Tomorrow?
Now, this is one I saw and reviewed within the last 10 years, and I'm ashamed to say I don't remember either.
Jake Gyllenhaal and Dennis Quaid.
I'm losing all my credibility here.
You've got to be able to do the last one,
though.
The original Planet of the Apes. Who survives?
Get your hands off me, you damn dirty ape.
And that's...
Charlton Heston.
Charlton Heston, nice.
I really did it.
You maniac!
You maniac.
That's the worst Charlton Heston impression I think I've ever heard.
That's early in the morning.
A supreme moment of overacting in the history of American cinema.
You maniacs.
And Tim from Woodbridge, one of our listeners, got that answer just before you did. A.O. Scott, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
It's Movie Friday.
All right, those are disasters on the screen, but what if you're in the middle of a disaster in your neighborhood? New numbers show home foreclosures up 19% since October last year, and we're asking, have you seen vacant houses in your neighborhood? And if you have, how has it changed your community?
This is Tessa. I'm calling from Warren, Michigan. We have a lot of foreclosed homes and vacant homes in our neighborhood. On my block alone, we have 6 empty homes on my block alone. It's a huge issue for our neighborhood.
And what about your neighborhood? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast at thetakeaway.org.
I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Well done.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special report.
Ladies and gentlemen, am I on? Ladies and gentlemen, here I am, back of a stone wall that adjoins Mr. Wilmer's garden. From here, I get a sweep of the whole scene. I'll give you every detail as long as I can talk and as long as I can see.
It sounded completely real, but the famous 1938 Orson Welles radio broadcast of a Martian invasion was just a bit of theater. In the broadcasting era, the simple words, "We go now live to the scene of a developing story," gets everyone's attention.
There are multiple shooters, and not one, but at least 2.
And possibly 3 different shooters, all in military fatigues.
The shooter was killed in that incident.
It was a terrible, terrible form of suicide, and he took all these others with him.
Last Thursday, while the tragic story at Fort Hood was real, all those facts were completely wrong. When the first draft of history is full of errors, word of mouth becomes word of myth. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. Thank God it's Friday, the 13th of November. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Good morning.
No need to be worried, John. It's okay. You're safe. Coming up, Colorado's $2 billion short of a balanced budget, and in many areas, that means people are going to lose their health care. Also, Viva Mexicanos! Lou Dobbs leaves CNN and Latinos claim victory. Plus, the CEOs of some of our largest companies say Congress has to pass health care reform or they won't be able to afford to pay for benefits, and it's the end of the world at the movies.
But first, let's bring Dave Cullen in here. He's the author of Columbine, about the Columbine High School massacre. Dave, how vulnerable do you think the media is to inadvertent myth-making in the confusion of an unfolding tragedy like we saw at Fort Hood?
Well, extremely vulnerable. It appears that we've already told one whopper already about the so-called hero. And someone like that one we pass along, but most of them are probably going to be of our own making, and it really is all going to depend on our discipline that we show on whether or not we speculate.
Yes or no here, Dave. Are there myths from the coverage of Columbine that still live on today, do you think?
Oh, most of the most important things we think we know about Columbine right now are myths.
Interesting. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. Dave Cullen, author of Columbine, talking about myth-making, the media, and the Fort Hood tragedy. But we'll be back at that discussion in just a second after the headlines this morning.
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the self-proclaimed mastermind of the September 11th attacks, is coming to New York. He and 4 other terrorism suspects are being moved from the Guantanamo Detention Center to face trial in a civilian federal court. This is President Obama speaking to reporters this morning in Tokyo.
I am absolutely convinced that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed will be subject to the most exacting demands of justice. The American people insist on it. My administration will insist on it.
The actual transfer of the suspects isn't expected for weeks because formal charges have never been filed. White House lawyer Gregory Craig is expected to resign today. Craig has struggled in his efforts to close the detention center at Guantanamo Bay, and he's expected to be replaced by President Obama's personal lawyer, Bob Bauer. President Obama also spoke in Tokyo about when we can expect a decision on the strategy in Afghanistan.
The decision will be made soon. It will be one that is fully transparent so that the American people understand exactly what we're doing and why we're doing it and what it will entail.
Today, the Japanese pledged $5 billion for the civilian effort in Afghanistan and another $1 billion for Pakistan.
large counterterrorism seizure, perhaps the largest in history. Federal prosecutors are moving to seize four American mosques and a Manhattan skyscraper owned by a Muslim organization. Prosecutors contend the Alavi Foundation funnels rental income to support Iran's nuclear program. And quickly, Europe's Rosetta spacecraft is making its final flyby past Earth today before it's going to attempt to land on a comet in 2014. So after 6 days of gains, the Dow drops nearly 100 points. S&P fell 11. The Nasdaq was slightly down. Futures trading suggests a bounce upward when Wall Street gets underway in about a half an hour. So we're talking about foreclosures and your neighborhood. What gaps exist in your neighborhood? Look on your block. Are there foreclosures, vacant properties? What does it mean in your neighborhood? How are you dealing with it? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. Myth-making, fact-checking, and when emotion takes over the media in an important story like the Fort Hood tragedy, with the benefit of about a week's hindsight, we can begin to see the facts emerging. Certainly a week ago when we were covering this story, there was a lot that was supposedly known about the tragedy that turned out not to be true. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. But the big story out of Fort Hood this morning, of course, the shooter, Nidal Malik Hassan, charged with 13 counts of premeditated murder yesterday. And that charge means he's eligible, shall we say, for the death penalty. And military prosecutors are hard at work of pushing that investigation forward. Campbell Robertson of our partner, The New York Times, is in Killeen, Texas, the town outside the base there at Fort Hood. He joins us now. Dave Cullen is still with us, the author of Columbine, about the Columbine High School massacre. Campbell Robertson, good morning.
Good morning.
So, first of all, let's talk about the charges that were filed. Not much surprise there. But anything about the demeanor or tone of military prosecutors that struck you?
Not particularly. I mean, there's a lot of investigation to go. There hasn't been any indication yet, and the fact that this is in a military court, I guess, is the strongest signifier that they still think that he has pretty much done this alone. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of investigation to go, but everything they're saying so far seems to signify a belief that he did this by himself.
And, you know, again, I don't want to get you into speculative zone here, but as you talk with members of the community, is there buzz that he might not have acted alone? I mean, there's no sort of facts that would support that at this point, but is that on people's minds?
Oh, of course. And, you know, especially for people who depend on the military, I mean, there's a lot of, people would be pretty frustrated if there were clear signs that this guy should have been tagged and dealt with long before this. And you know, you definitely pick that up talking with people in the community that they want to make sure that the military did all they could to keep tabs on a guy like this and to make sure this didn't happen.
Let's talk about victims' families. How are they doing? It's a week later. Of course, the 13 were killed, and their families have one thing to deal with, but there were many who were injured.
You know, I think the hard part is kind of starting. I mean, you know, this segment began, I guess, on the show today about the media, and in a weird way, it sort of allows the survivors to put off dealing with it, because it's just been a complete, you know, it's a madhouse of TV cameras and reporters down here for a week, and people are kind of, you know, the media's kind of moving out of here, and I think now it's going to get to some really hard times for the survivors, because now they're kind of just left themselves to deal with this.
You know, there was a fact that we reported on the program last Friday that was sourced to a doctor who was told by someone at a hospital that when Nidal Malik Hassan opened fire, he was screaming the Arabic God is great, Allahu Akbar. Describe how you confirmed that fact, because that's one of those myth-making, too-hot-to-handle kind of details that, if not true, could cause people to draw all kinds of conclusions.
You know, it kind of surprises me that this element has gotten such attention. I mean, obviously it's important, but with all the other details. But in any case, you know, we first heard it from an eyewitness and one eyewitness, and then two congressmen who were briefed by witnesses. And since then, in our reporting about the survivors and about the wounded, we've heard it confirmed, you know, I guess 3, 4, 5 times, I'd have to look at my notebook, by witnesses who were in the room. It's it's pretty much every eyewitness who was there when the shooting started that we've talked to has confirmed that that he did say Allahu Akbar.
All right. Well, Campbell Robertson, thanks for the update. New York Times reporter in Killeen, Texas, reporting on the aftermath a week later of the Fort Hood tragedy. Dave Cullen now, author of Columbine, about the Columbine High School massacre. You know, you can hear in Campbell Robertson's voice the mix of worry, fear, mythology, concern, and the fact-checking that's required to keep things on the straight and narrow. What are your reactions?
Well, I think that's the right approach. And I think the media has really gotten so much better since Columbine. We collectively, I think, have learned our lessons. You've just got to be really careful. The Allah Akbar thing you were just talking about is crucial because people will conclude so much from that. And it sounds like they have, you know, they've pushed, they've talked to a lot of people. My single caution there is compromised witnesses. Hopefully, I assume he's gone back to some of those witnesses that had the chance to go back and ask them how they know this and if they heard it directly. Because so often one witness will go on TV, it'll get to TV, other witnesses will hear it, and will repeat that without having heard it themselves. And sometimes they come to believe they've heard it, because memory is really, really open to persuasion.
And that's like the story of this alleged hero woman who was said to have stopped him by shooting him. It turned out not to be true. In thinking about Columbine this morning, I was reminded that there was a religious dimension to that story. Remind us of what that was all about.
Yes, you know, one of the really biggest, most enduring myths about Columbine is this idea of this Christian martyr, Cassie Bernal, who the story went, was asked by one of the killers whether she believed in God. She said yes, and then he killed her. And that actually became the title of a best-selling book, She Said Yes, The Unlikely Martyrdom of Cassie Bernal.
Wow.
Written by her mother, who I think believed it at the time. It turned out to just be a complete misunderstanding. Another girl, Val Schnurr, had a conversation with a killer. She had already been shot multiple times, really badly wounded, close to dying, but she lived to tell. So it was one witness, Craig Scott, who was sitting under a table, who heard the conversation, who jumped to an incorrect conclusion about who it was, and the story took off from there. You know, I actually interviewed Val Schnurr, the girl who really said it, for about 5 hours earlier this week, and she is really to this day still haunted by that mix-up, because so many people accused her of being a liar and trying to profit off the copy or the the myth. So
you make an amazing point. People are so suggestible at moments like this. The experience of learning something that is that haunting and devastating has its own reality. Even if the fact is wrong, the reaction to it becomes its own story. Dave Cullen, thanks so much. It's interesting context. Author of Columbine, about the Columbine High School massacre, comparing in some sense with some of the myths or potential myths coming out of the Fort Hood tragedy. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks for having me.
And now it's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in on some of the headlines we're following this morning.
President Obama met with Japan's new prime minister today. The meeting was aimed at strengthening ties with Japan. At a joint news conference, the president said he's confident the two countries will remain closely allied. At the same conference, President Obama said his decision on how many troops to send to Afghanistan is coming soon. He said his goal is to, quote, get this right.
Staying with Afghanistan, Britain's prime minister says NATO countries may send 5,000 more troops to the country. The move would offer key support as the U.S. decides whether to increase American troop levels there. In economic news, the Federal Reserve will begin banning banks from charging many overdraft fees unless customers sign up for the service. The new rules take effect July 1st, and they are in response to complaints from regulators that the fees are unfair. New estimates on the toll of the H1N1 virus in the United States. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says about 22 million Americans have contracted the virus in the past 6 months, and around 4,000 have died.
The Colorado couple who reported their son missing aboard a runaway balloon is due in court today. The two are accused of staging an elaborate hoax as a publicity stunt. They're expected to plead guilty. Army psychiatrist Major Nadal Malik Hassan has been charged with 13 counts of premeditated murder in the Fort Hood shootings. Under the military's legal system, the charges make Hassan eligible for the death penalty if he's convicted. And finally, a storm system blamed for at least 5 deaths on the East Coast is expected to weaken today, but it could threaten more states. The storms caused flooding, power outages, and school closures. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, New York Times film critic A.O. Scott reviews the movies that America will be watching this weekend and telling you which ones you should be watching. That's in just a few minutes.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Time for some takeouts. Yeah, we got your news to go here. We're going to start in Washington with our correspondent there, Todd Zwillick. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, Celeste. Good morning.
So we want to talk about a couple numbers that have come out. I mean, first of all, we get this report from the Business Roundtable, which is basically a large organization of CEOs of large businesses. And basically what they've said is they've issued a warning to Congress saying, if you do not pass some kind of efficient, workable health care reform, we may not be able to afford to cover our employees, right?
Well, businesses have been saying this for years and years. You know, it used to be just sort of the consumer advocates wanted health reform, you know, give everybody health insurance. And in recent years, that has really shifted. It's now across the economy. Business leaders say they need reform or they just won't be able to afford it. And the Business Roundtable is a group of the top CEOs from huge companies across the country. Right now, it costs about $10,700 on average per employee for a business to cover healthcare. That's premiums, that's taxes, that's cost sharing, that's all the stuff that your employer would have to pay. They said if health reform doesn't happen over the next 10 years, it'll go from $10,700 to $28,500, which is well more than double. It's like 170% rise. That's the worst case scenario. So that's if you do nothing, it's going to totally break the bank. So this was a major shot across the bow for Congress, you know, get something done. Democrats, of course, have seized on this number and say, see, Republicans, we have to have reform. Don't stand in our way. But really, I see this a little bit differently. It's really a shot at Democrats themselves. Stop bickering over things like abortion and the small details and make sure you get reform done, because the business leaders are crying for it.
Right. And the other thing is that the Democrats have said that their health care reform is going to cut money off the deficit. And since we got these numbers for October showing that the deficit is enormous, that could be another argument for them to get moving on and health care reform, right?
Well, it will cut some dollars off the deficit, but only shave, you know, a couple of $10 billion off the deficit, probably, which is nothing when you look at the latest figures. The Treasury Department said yesterday that the deficit for October was a record $176 billion, which is a huge number. But the deficit for all of fiscal 2009, which just ended on October 1st.
Right.
$101.42 trillion.
Yeah. Well, Todd, you're spending the weekend going to see Devo in 2 separate concerts, but I imagine unless there was a concert movie made of them, our next guest, A.O. Scott, wouldn't be reviewing Devo.
Twist away the gates of steel Sunday
fun.
And Monday night.
Have fun, Todd. So A.O. Scott, film critic for the New York Times and Takeaway contributor, joins us here in the studio with your takeout on movies. It's not a huge weekend because 2012, the movie that's the blockbuster, mm-hmm. is really kind of crowding out everything else. It's classic sort of boy meets girl, boy opens a portal into a parallel universe, boy prevents ancient Mayan prophecy from becoming true.
A quiet little drama, full of sensitive performances,
exactly.
And very, 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 very modest,
but irresistible,
low-budget indie thing.
Irresistible entertainment.
The whole planet is destroyed. Irresistible for the first hour and a half of the 2.5 hours.
Ooh,
and a half hours. I just think if you're going to destroy the world, you have to do it a little more efficiently.
Now listen to this clip, because I'm having a little problem with 2012. I don't know if it's a comedy or a drama. Listen.
It seems to me that the worst is over.
Now, That's a Germanic sounding governor of California trying to reassure people. Are you sure that's not a Saturday Night Live skit?
Well, there's some humor. I mean, this movie is very aware of its own preposterousness, right down to the special effects. You have my favorite sequence, the destruction of Los Angeles, where you have John Cusack driving a stretch limousine, basically outrunning an earthquake. He's driving along and the fault line is opening up right behind his car and all the houses are spilling into it. And that's fun for a while, and it's certainly fun to watch Woody Harrelson playing a kind of a survivalist nut job who turns out to be exactly right about everything.
Yeah, of course.
He's in a trailer in Yellowstone.
As destructions of L.A. go, is it better than Day After Tomorrow? That was another destruction.
Well, also from Roland Emmerich, who's I don't know what he has against the city of Los Angeles, which obviously pays his rent pretty well.
Yeah,
but,
you liked it, though. I liked it.
I got really bored at the end when they're all loaded up on these big giant arcs in the Himalayas waiting for the tsunami to wash them all away. And then it just becomes kind of like too much water and too much yelling and screaming. But up until then, as planetary destruction goes, it was kind of fun.
You have nothing good to say about Pirate Radio with Philip Seymour Hoffman, so let's not dwell on that.
Yeah.
But Wes Anderson getting into animation with the Fantastic Mr. Fox, a couple of words on that?
That's a nice movie. I mean, it's a Wes Anderson movie through and through, and in a way, I think some of the attention to detail and the fussiness and preciousness of his other movies actually works well with this. It's done with stop motion animation with puppets with a great voice cast, George Clooney, Meryl Streep. It's a really interesting movie. It's odd, but odd, I think, in a very nice way.
Two good suggestions from A.O. Scott, film critic for the New York Times and Takeaway contributor. Fantastic Mr. Fox and 2012, at least for the first hour and a half. Thanks, Tony.
Right. One more takeout, and it's about a very simple question that we asked yesterday. Will China rule the world? And you had a lot to say.
The Chinese already have more people who speak English than we have Americans. Yes, they will take over.
As far as China goes, I think it would be a good idea for the rest of the world to merge with China. War would become extinct, and I, for one, enjoy my wonton soup.
Good morning, Troy calling from Dakota. China won't take over the world. Kazakhstan will. That Borat movie probably made them angry enough to pull it off.
Thank you, Troy. We also talked yesterday about a White House plan to have states compete for education money. Here's a reaction.
I taught at public schools for at-risk kids for 4 years, and where if you have a school with very high-performing students, your test scores can go up and up and up. Whereas if you have students who keep coming in and they're in your program simply to graduate and they just want to pass, you're lucky if you have high passing rates as hard as you work.
React to anything on the program at 8778-MY-TAKE, mytake@thetakeaway.org. You know how to reach us. I love those reactions to Will China Rule the World.
cleverness of our listeners.
Yes, I was accused of coming up with a comic book question there, but I love
those
really
responses.
It's true. They're the best.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, a $2 billion budget hole in Colorado means less money for education and less money for Medicaid, and it could mean fewer people can get treated. We're going to talk about that in just a few moments. But first, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes past the hour. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the self-proclaimed mastermind of the September 11th attacks, will be moving to New York to face a civilian trial. Speaking to reporters in Tokyo this morning, President Obama said Mohammed will be subject to the most exacting demands of justice. The transfer of Mohammed and four other suspected terrorists from Guantanamo Bay isn't expected for weeks because formal charges have never been filed. The announcement comes on the same day as White House lawyer Gregory Craig is expected to resign. Craig had struggled to lead the closure of the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center. He's expected to be replaced by President Obama's personal lawyer, Bob Bauer.
President Obama also spoke in Tokyo this morning about Japan's contributions to the war in Afghanistan.
I did thank the people of Japan and the prime ministers for the powerful commitment of a $5 billion over the next 5 years to support our shared civilian efforts in Afghanistan, as well as the commitment of $1 billion to Pakistan.
That's for the civilian efforts in Afghanistan and Pakistan. The president said his decision on military strategy in Afghanistan will come soon. Also this morning, British Prime Minister Gordon Brown says NATO may contribute 5,000 more troops to Afghanistan. Europe's Rosetta spacecraft is making a final flyby past Earth today. It will use the planet's gravity to slingshot into space for a quick look at an asteroid before it attempts to land on a comet in 2014. And here's a story we found this morning, and you know, check your pockets, folks. What are the top three most shoplifted items? TikTok.
Boots.
New report puts them as cosmetics, perfumes, and razor blades. The report, which may explain why they're always locked up. The report, based on a survey of retail companies, says shoplifting is up nearly 9% this year.
It means
with over $42 billion in goods stolen.
It just means we really value being pretty, well-shaved, and smelling good.
Yeah, right. Personal grooming thieves. Well-groomed thieves in America. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
We're wrapping up our week-long series on the impact of budget cuts in states across the United States. And today we're looking at Colorado. Colorado faces nearly a $2 billion deficit. That means a lot of things are being cut, obviously, in Colorado. A lot of social services. They've cut funding for education. There's even a so-called Twinkie tax that they've added to candy and soda pop. And state employees are taking unpaid furlough days in order to save state money. But we're just going to look at one particular slice of the budget crisis in Colorado. We're going to talk about Medicaid. It's not the biggest cut that Colorado residents are facing, but it's one that is rather telling. We're joined right now by Mitzi Moran. She's the president and CEO of Sunrise Community Health. That's a health center in Evans, Colorado. And Mitzi, you've seen a 14% funding decrease in the past year, and you say that that's mainly impacting your lower-income patients. What do you mean?
Well, we have seen about $2.6 million reduction in our state funding. And as a result, we are immediately, you know, moving the levers you have direct control over. Pay freeze, hiring freeze, no more 401ks, absolutely no capital purchases, you know, all those things that you have direct control over. And now we're just waiting with bated breath to see what the next round of cuts are. Because
right.
We are down to zero budget and forced very, very soon to be looking at program reductions.
Okay, so the governor, Bill Ritter, has announced on Tuesday he's going to cut the rates by which medical providers get reimbursed for Medicaid patients. This is different than the funding cuts that you were talking about before. And how are these particular cuts going to make changes in what you can do if you're already at the edge of disaster?
Okay, well, just like any physician office, you have your revenue streams. And there are a variety of them. Any one of them gets seriously cut, it impacts your entire infrastructure. So, you know, our diabetic educator, our case management programs, or a physician team is supported by multiple funding sources. If one of them is decreased dramatically, we may no longer be able to sustain that program.
All right, so let's hear from Tim Hoover now. Tim is a state house reporter for the Denver Post. And Tim, you may have heard, this Medicaid cut that the governor announced on Tuesday is certainly not the largest cut. With a $2 billion deficit in Colorado, what other things are really seeing decreases there?
Well, Medicaid, despite facing yet another provider rate reduction, it's ironic because the state still is spending more on Medicaid than it ever has before. Part of that is owing to the fact that it has expanded eligibility for Medicaid recently and is continuing to do so. So more people are able to get on the program, and with so many people out of work, that has just simply added to it. So since fiscal year 07-08 through probably the end of the next fiscal year, they're looking at what would probably be a 45% increase.
Okay, so if Medicaid is not the biggest the biggest hit the state has taken, what are the biggest hits the state is taking?
Primarily in education. The state has continually sliced higher education, which is not protected by any sort of constitutional mandates for spending. And the only reason it hasn't, you know, cut it essentially to zero is because in doing so, it would lose a ton more federal stimulus money, as well as K-12 education. that historically has been protected by a constitutional amendment that says funding's got to increase every year for education in Colorado. Well, the governor's office this year has pointed to what it believes is a loophole that will allow it to cut education public schools by the tune of $260 million, which would be about a 4.6% cut. It's okay. The first time that K-12 education has had to face a cut, but the governor says, look, we've cut everywhere else.
There's nowhere else to cut. Mitzi, I mean, I don't think anyone in Colorado is saying that Medicaid is the worst area in which the budget cuts are being felt. But give me a real example. If you guys are losing this kind of funding, seeing these drastic reductions in funding, what does that mean for say, low-income people, for your Medicaid patients who rely on you for treatment? Does this mean they get reduced treatment? Does it mean some of them are just going to lose the ability to get treated?
Well, first off, the state is in a terrible position, and they are having to make horrible decisions. I mean, I have tons of empathy for our legislators at the moment. What it means on the ground for us, as Medicaid is cut and other state funding is cut for community health centers, is we have 1,000 people on our waiting list. If they cannot get into the outpatient setting to get their diabetes and their chronic disease cared for, they end up hitting the emergency room, being hospitalized. Their depth and breadth of disease becomes much more dramatic, and that's the health of the individual. But it is bigger than that. It's the health of the community, the state. If people are healthy, they can work. If their children are healthy, they perform in school. If your schools are doing well and you have a workforce, your community does better. So it's impacting individuals who don't have access to health care, and it's impacting our entire community.
And as we heard from Tim, these are people who may have lost their jobs and may not have been in the traditional Medicare recipient category, but now, because they're unemployed, are eligible for Medicare and really need Medicaid, I should say, in order to get health care coverage.
The recession has increased the need.
That's exactly right. At the same time that the recession has cut the amount of money that we're able to spend on Medicaid.
But I thought stimulus money was supposed to go to preventing layoffs and preventing, you know, these kinds of Medicaid cuts.
I think by the time the stimulus money hit the states, they were just trying to stop hemorrhaging, let alone Band-Aid small cuts. That's Mitzi Moran, president and CEO of the Sunrise Community Health Center in Greeley, Colorado. We also heard from Tim Hoover, State House reporter for the Denver Post. Thanks to both of you. We've been hearing all this week about cuts in the state budgets across the country that really hurt people, and there are way more stories about this that we couldn't have time to cover. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And it's fair to say a huge story is unfolding now, with details emerging in Tokyo, where the president is, in Washington, and in New York City. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, it appears, the self-described mastermind of the September 11th, 2001 attacks, and four other men accused in the plot, will be prosecuted in federal court in New York City, which means they'll be moved from Guantanamo Bay. Apparently the story that emerged this morning, sourced to a federal law enforcement official or an anonymous White House official early today, means that we're starting to learn how the president will deal with the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center and the disposition of the detainees. And it appears that some will go to civilian courts, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and some will stay in military tribunals, possibly detainees associated with the attack on the coal in 2000, that bombing of the coal in Yemen. Joining us now to help explain the details as sketchily as we know them this morning is Jonathan Mahler, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, author of the book The Challenge: How a Maverick Navy Officer and a Young Law Professor Risked Their Careers to Defend the Constitution and Won. Jonathan is in Brooklyn. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, you know, this is sort of the emotional question right off the top, and you can dismiss it, but I'm wondering if you'd react to the idea of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed on trial in open federal court in New York,
yeah,
in the Southern District in Lower Manhattan, a stone's throw literally from ground zero. I mean, that is pretty monumental.
It is. I mean, I think, it's interesting because, I mean, when we go back to the fall of 2001 in the wake of 9/11, when the Bush administration first created these military tribunals where they were intending to ultimately try these guys on Guantanamo, one of the principal reasons why they did so, or one of the many reasons, I guess you could say, was that they wanted to avoid that. They wanted to avoid bringing these guys, who had just committed the most sort of
outrageous act of terrorism against this nation and its history, they wanted to avoid bringing them onto American soil, you know, let alone down into the vicinity of Ground Zero. But actually, you know, looked at another way. I mean, what could be more symbolically powerful than to try these guys in the shadow of where this you know, horrific act occurred?
Well, Jonathan, as you well know, this also is a huge risk on the part of the Obama administration. I mean, one of the things we know from your reporting and others is that Mr. Mohammed was waterboarded more than 180 times back in 2003. How does that affect his ability to testify or respond to whatever evidence they got in those interrogations?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that the federal court is going to, that and whatever judge is assigned to this case is going to have to work out, and it's going to be very complicated. And it certainly was you know, another reason why the Bush administration was so eager to avoid the federal court system, for this very reason that you know, that it was quite possible that all the evidence that the government had against these guys could be thrown out by a federal judge, because it was potentially all obtained through torture. So you know, I don't think that the Obama administration would have decided to do this if it didn't feel strongly that it had the goods, that it had evidence that would actually be admissible in a federal court.
And what more we might learn about 9/11 is something else that will come up in this trial. But, but very, very quickly, less than 30 seconds, does this decision really spell the beginning of the end for Gitmo?
Well, it does. Certainly, this is very much sort of a part of President Obama's plan to close Gitmo. Though of course he had vowed to do so by January 22nd.
Well, we'll see what happens.
Looking like that's not going to happen.
Weeks away from actual returning or bringing the detainees to New York. Jonathan Mahler, thanks for that. The author of the book The Challenge: How a Maverick Navy Officer and a Young Law Professor Risked Their Careers to Defend the Constitution and Won. Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. Lou Dobbs famously resigned from CNN. His last broadcast is this week. Why did he leave CNN? Could it be because of all the complaints from Latino activists about his prejudice? Or is it really simply about ratings? That story in just a few minutes. But first, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. President Obama has arrived in Japan for the first stop in his trip to the Far East. He met the new Prime Minister, Yukio Hatoyama, who took power in September. Japan's new government says it wants a more equal relationship with the United States.
The president's trip will also include an economic summit in Singapore and stops in China and South Korea. And he's already referenced the big story emerging here in New York and Tokyo and Washington. The self-proclaimed September 11th mastermind, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, will be sent to New York for a federal trial along with four other Guantanamo Bay detainees. Moving the detainees to the U.S. is a key step in the president's plan to close that detention center in Cuba. Joining us now is a justice reporter for the Washington Post, Carrie Johnson. And Carrie, good morning.
Good morning.
So we're going to learn a lot more about both the disposition of Guantanamo Bay and each of these individual cases, and we still don't know how many they are total. We have Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, maybe four other detainees on 9/11, and an unspecified other number of detainees. When Eric Holder, the Attorney General, speaks later today, what are you most interested in when Holder faces the media?
That's right. We know that he's going to announce, or we suspect he's going to announce, the fate of six detainees: Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the self-described mastermind of 9/11, one of his cousins, a Saudi financier, Ramzi bin al-Shib, whose name may be familiar. All of those men are going to the Southern District of New York for trial. And among the open questions in my mind is whether they are going to be tried together in a proceeding that may turn into a rather circus-like environment, given how some of these defendants have behaved in military commission so far at Gitmo. Another open question is how hard defense lawyers for them are going to push to introduce evidence that some of them, including KSM himself, was waterboarded and treated with interrogation techniques that some critics liken to torture.
Yeah, and the other issue, and again, Holder will have to speak to it, and thanks for that, Carrie Johnson, is whether classified information will have to be used to supplement the interrogation information from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed if it's not permitted to be used in open court because of the torture issue. A huge story. We're following it this morning, and we'll be following it next week on The Takeaway as well.
Yes, it's my last chance.
Last dance for Lou Dobbs on CNN this week. Sad day for some, and yet for others, they're celebrating. In fact, we have many Latino activist organizations this week claiming a victory over the resignation of Lou Dobbs. And to explain why they're celebrating, we have Gustavo Arellano, staff writer with OC Weekly and journalist behind the syndicated column Ask a Mexican. He joins us from California, where it's quite early. Good morning, Gustavo.
Hello.
So, first of all, explain to me, what was the problem that some of these Latino activist organizations had with Lou Dobbs? Why were they constantly protesting him?
It wasn't just Latino organizations. It was also organizations like Media Matters and people, frankly, who don't want liars on the air. And that was a big thing with Lou Dobbs. Lou Dobbs would spout nothing but lies upon lies that would then transform into jeremiads against immigrants, specifically immigrants from Mexico. That was a big problem that people had. The reasoning was, we don't want a voice like Lou Dobbs on a legitimate news network like CNN. But come on, the reality was that they didn't want Lou Dobbs because he's a liar.
And now many of these Latino activist organizations are claiming victory and saying that at least they played a significant role in CNN, they say, letting him go. Do you buy that?
I would hope so, and I say I would hope so because right now we don't know the real reasoning behind Dobbs leaving CNN. We don't know if the brass at CNN said, you know what, you're just alienating too many Latino viewers, and we're going to kick them off. Although I do have to say, for a good year or so, CNN stuck by Lou Dobbs, and even after Lou left CNN, the head of CNN said nothing but nice words about him, saying we're happy to see him take his activist brand of journalism somewhere else. I'm paraphrasing here. And so at the very least, those organizations behind BossaDobbs.com at least put the message out there, and we're getting increasingly more media attention from the New York Times and other organizations. But it remains to be seen, what are the real reasons for Dobbs leaving? Maybe Dobbs wants to be a politician. That's the reason why he left. We still don't know right now.
Okay, well at least get a couple answers from our next guest. Johnny Roberts is a media analyst. So Johnny, you just heard Gustavo pretty much say that Lou Dobbs is a liar. Is that common knowledge? Is that something we can just accept without questioning?
Well, certainly Lou Dobbs wouldn't regard himself as a liar, but I think it was a combination of factors behind Lou's exit from a network there that he spent a good chunk of his career, 30 years. It's not a good thing to alienate a big part of the audience out there, or a potential big part of your audience out there. Clearly, CNN wants Latinos to come to that network. They've run special programming in order to attract Latinos to that network. At the same time, Lou was kind of upside down with the management of the network on other fronts.
This is all internal. There was the birthing thing. About Barack Obama's birth certificate. Yeah.
And also, to your guest's point, Lou was upside down with the branding of the network. The network brands itself as a sort of Switzerland of cable television news.
Right.
Not
opinion. We're in the middle ground in between Fox News and MSNBC.
Exactly. A straight, more traditional news telecast. And Lou was kind of upside down with that branding.
Yeah, his audience was not the same as Anderson Cooper, say. This calls into mind that particular question, this kind of a larger argument maybe on the activism of news networks. As you said, we have Fox Network, stereotypically very far to the right. We've got MSNBC with Keith Olbermann, stereotypically far to the left. And we had this odd occurrence between Jon Stewart of The Daily Show and Sean Hannity of Fox this week. Let's take a listen.
It seems Sean Hannity used footage of a bigger crowd from a totally different event to make last week's GOP healthcare rally appear more heavily attended.
Although it pains me to say this, Jon Stewart, Comedy Central, he was right. So, Mr. Stewart, you were right. We apologize. But by the way, I want to thank you and all your writers for watching.
I mean, when a comedy show is driving the Fox News network, all these cable networks are marginal. They're meaningless. Their audiences are tiny. They're irrelevant, I think.
Yeah, you know what? This is all about business here, and I think a point in time to look at is, you know, the startup of Fox Network. You know, Fox or the owners of Fox, Rupert Murdoch, started that network because he saw an opening in the marketplace. He characterized, demonized, if you will, CNN as a liberal network. So he launched his network in order to bring a more balanced approach. What that meant in practical terms is more of the conservative view. And there was an audience out there for that. And you saw that MSNBC took a page from that book, seeing that
and
as a successful route, went the other route.
But Gustavo, I'm wondering, we're talking about these being very marginalized audiences, but many activist organizations, not just Latinos, say, you know, it's fine to say that they have their particular audiences and it's not the general populace of the United States. But these activist organizations say, look, what happens on these TV shows influences public policy and it ends up hurting people. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Look at what's happened with Glenn Beck and his various crusades against people in the Obama administration, where eventually some of these people have had to resign. Van Jones, of course, being the most notorious example. And also, when you the way media works is, if somebody states it, then people assume, oh, well, it has to be fact. If somebody on CNN is saying that, for instance, Latinos have brought in 3,000 cases of leprosy in the past 3 years.
I think the takeaway for me here is, you know, I belong to the Society of Professional Journalists. They say that the aim is to always maintain an appearance of objectivity, even if you can't always be completely objective. But it looks like maybe we've left the appearance of objectivity behind in some circles.
And that's certainly the case in primetime. That's where these networks are branded. And it's a political branding that's going on.
Okay, Johnny Roberts is a media analyst. We also heard from Gustavo Arellano, staff writer for OC Weekly and the journalist behind the syndicated column Ask a Mexican.
So enjoy your weekend, but all next week, all week.
Super Freakonomics.
That's right. To enlarge your mind, Super Freakonomics co-author Stephen Dubner will join the takeaway to talk about prostitutes, climate change, and anything else super freaky, the position on which can be changed if you just open your mind to Super Freakonomics.
But today we're talking about the housing crisis and how it's affecting your communities, and we're talking about empty homes. Look down your block. Do you have vacant homes on your block and in your neighborhood, and how is it affecting your community? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Catch up on anything on the show at the podcast you can get at takeaway.org, our website. There's still more of this Friday the 13th to go. Be careful. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.